Bon, merci. Alors, je veux d'abord remercier les organisatrices, organisateurs de cet événement, de ce colloque. Je vais passer à l'anglais pour la présentation. Et, je crois que bon, on peut aussi discuter en français. So, I'm going to talk about Egypt in the period of Mehmed Ali. And just to situate that a little bit in terms of time, because I think most people know where Egypt is in terms of space. This is before the direct British occupation, which Didier talked about before lunch. And but it's after the brief and failed French occupation of Egypt by the forces of the Revolutionary Army under Napoleon. Which was in 1798 to 1801. So after the French leave Egypt, an army is sent by the Ottoman Empire to repossess the province, one of its richest provinces. And one of the officers of this force, the second in command of an Albanian contingent called Mehmed Ali, who's from Rumelia, so what's now kind of European Turkey or up here, made himself effectively by 1811 the de facto ruler of Egypt. That's a famous picture of him, Mehmed Ali Pasha. And he started a quite ambitious program of state building and of, if you like, you know, appropriating space within Egypt and outside it. So within Egypt itself, in 1811, he basically eliminated the previous ruling class of Egypt who'd ruled Egypt under the Ottomans, who were the Ottoman Mamluks. He massacred many of them in Cairo Citadel, famously, but he also basically took back the tax farms, the iltizams, which that had been the main support for their Mamluk households, and tried to control them more directly by the state, obviously using other elites and other kind of retainers to do that, but within initially quite sort of a tight control of the state. We can talk more in questions perhaps about the actual kind of land tenure arrangements and so on. But the other one of the other main things that this period is known for, so basically from sort of 1820s through 1830s, is that he began this process of turning Egypt's economy into a cotton exporting economy directed towards Europe. So long staple cotton, jumel cotton, is introduced, and peasants are essentially forced to grow that in the Nile Delta alongside their food crops that they'd already grown. And there's quite sort of detailed sets of regulations that he issues periodically, how the peasants are to plant crops and to be very careful about them. And you know, he also initiates many of the other kind of repertoire of state building that we've heard quite a lot about in the context of European colonial empires, so things like cadastres, surveying projects, infrastructure projects, particularly the canal and port of Alexandria, which becomes the main sort of export port towards Europe. He's also trying to set himself up as the ruler, as the main or the only exporter of cotton, the only merchant essentially, who European merchants or other Ottoman subjects who are also merchants have to deal with. I mean, obviously, like so many of these kind of grand enterprises of state building, it's not completely successful. There's lots of resistance. There's lots of people who, peasants who sell cotton on the side privately. There's lots of peasants who flee to escape the very sort of repressive and harsh regime that's instituted in many of the villages, and also to escape military conscription. Because a lot of this use of Egypt's resources is really designed to serve his army and his expansionist ambitions. So this is a map of, basically the Asian provinces of the Ottoman Empire. which I'll explain later where the map comes from. But I think I've got it on here, actually. So basically, there's a number of military campaigns that his armies fight over the course of a couple of decades, which I'll just put up here briefly, down to the Hejaz, against the Wahhabis, which later became the Saudi state, in 1811. That's not very good. down to Sudan, which becomes a long-lasting imperial possession of Egypt, 1820. Yeah, I'm sure you can deal with this. He also intervenes on behalf of the Ottoman Sultan against the Greek independence movement, against the Greek rebels in the 1820s. And in the course of that, also occupies Crete, which is an Egyptian possession for quite a long period. And he also invades Syria and holds Syria for most of the 1830s. So 1831, he forces under his son into Syria. They actually enter Anatolia and go as far as Konya, which is about where that arrow ends, and defeat the Ottoman forces there. And then basically they're on the road to Istanbul. And, so he's... and there's also an expedition to Yemen. So in a sense, it's interesting, actually. In a sense, he's expanding along Egypt's main trade routes and trying to, again, appropriate lots of other resources that exist in these parts of the world. So, down to get slaves and manpower, also minerals, particularly gold, that he hopes to find down in Sudan, to get things like silk, also wood for shipbuilding and the infrastructure projects that he's starting in Egypt from Syria. There's very little wood in Egypt. So he's appropriating a lot of territory, she said. So obviously he doesn't do this entirely by himself. In order to put in place a state building project, he builds up a new army and also a new civilian bureaucracy. The main part of this in the period that we're looking at, which is basically the 1830s, are Ottoman speakers. So Ottoman Turkish in language and culture from various parts of the Ottoman Empire, some from his own family and his own region of Rumelia, some Albanians, some from Anatolia, all over. There's also a certain number of Europeans who are employed as technicians and as military leaders, and who often bring very useful knowledge into his state system. Many of them somewhat eccentric characters, like some of those that we've encountered earlier on, but they're very much under the control of the Ottoman hierarchy and of Mehmed Ali himself. There's also, through the 1830s and increasingly after that, there's also quite an important section of the civilian bureaucracy, which is native Arabic-speaking Egyptians. Not so much in the military, because the military is seen, at least the officer corps of the military, is seen as much more the domain of Ottoman Turkish speakers. But there's this, particularly in education and things like engineering and medicine, there's a considerable chunk of his service that's Egyptian. And in particular, the bit that I'm going to talk about are a group who form around this guy, Rifat Tatawi, relatively well-known figure in the 1830s. So Rifat Tatawi is famous largely because he went to Paris. An Egyptian who studies at Al-Azhar, the Islamic University in Cairo. He's from Upper Egypt, from a village called Tata, and he is one. So he's trained at Al-Azhar, and unlike most of the kind of ulama, religiously trained intellectuals of Egypt at the time, he joins the administration of Mehmed Ali, which most of them are pretty sceptical about at the beginning, and they because they tend to be linked to the earlier kind of Mamluk order or to merchant groups in Cairo, say that Mehmed Ali is also going against their interests quite considerably. So he's he and also the group that form around him later on are people who tend to be from Upper Egyptian backgrounds, rural, sort of village level elites, sons of village sheikhs, this kind of thing, but not kind of a really central elite in the Egyptian state before this. So the state, or Mehmed Ali's new state building project, is really their kind of route to greater greater power and wealth and so on. So he accompanies an Egyptian, both Ottoman and Arabic, so, you know, Ottoman Turkish and Arabic speaking educational mission to Paris. He's in Paris between 1826 and 1831. He writes a famous kind of autobiographical account of this, which some of you may have encountered. L'Or de Paris is the French translation, Imam in Paris is Daniel Newman's English one. When he returns to Egypt, he becomes the head of a translation school, well, slightly after that, so in 1836. So he becomes kind of the chief of a whole sort of section of the educational service, whose main purpose is to translate books from French into Arabic for the purposes of the new state-run school system that is training in Arabic largely civilian bureaucrats to work in Mehmed Ali's state apparatus, in Ottoman Turkish more the military side. So within this, Tahtawi's own specialism in these early years through the 1830s is really the translation of geography books. Obviously, he's supervising quite a sort of big part of the Egyptian educational establishment, but his actual, what he's translating himself, is mostly geography. This starts when he's in Paris. He's part of he studies at the Egyptian school in Paris, the director of which is Edmé François Jomard, who's the editor of the Description de l'Égypte. In the earlier Napoleonic expedition to Egypt. He later on, you know, then goes on to become the head of this school, which is training Egyptians, whether Ottoman or Arabic speaking. And he is a geographer, essentially. I mean, you know, that's one of his main interests. And Tahtawi is really one of his kind of star pupils. So during the 1830s, he translates or rewrites a number of different geography books into Arabic. These are some of them. I won't go into these in a vast amount of detail because I'm aware that I need to get on to the other parts. But this is one that's actually originally printed, there on the left, by Protestant missionaries in Malta in Arabic. It's based on English language geography books, one of which is there, Channing Woodbridge's Rudiments of Geography. Another one is more, it's kind of an ethnography, it's a early ethnography, Dépens, Aperçu historique sur les mœurs et coutumes des nations, which he translates while he's in Paris. The other one, which we'll come on to a bit later on, is Malte-Brun's Précis de la géographie universelle, which is, a sort of late Enlightenment geography. I mean, Malte-Brun is a geographer who, I think this is published originally in the sort of 1810s, but he's active in that kind of revolutionary period. He's Danish, but he publishes in French, he works in France. But the one which I'm going to talk about more is this one in Arabic. Its title is At-Taribe Tashafia Limurid al-Jughrafia, so the salutary Arabizations for he who is seeking geography, literally, but basically it is the main text that it's based on is a French primary school book. This is one of those books that was published in vast quantities in this period after the Loi Guizot was passed for primary school education in France. So Hachette is running out sort of tens of thousands of copies of these things. And so it's called the Nouvelle Géographie Méthodique. It's by two instituteurs, primary school teachers called Achille Meissas and Auguste Michelot. And it's based on, it's a school book, so it's based on these sort of earlier Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment geographies. But again, he this is not his only source. He also adds in material from Malte-Brun's book, which I've just described, which is a much more kind of extensive, it's in several volumes, 14 or 15 volumes. And it's really a kind of a work of original research. And he also adds some information which is supplied to him by Jomard himself. Sorry, there should have been a picture of Jomard there, but again, it seems to be broken. So Jomard writes for him a memorandum which actually contains national statistics, which is quite an interesting addition that he made. I won't go into that because I don't have time. Basically, he recognises the fact that these European geography books cover areas of knowledge that are not really available in other Arabic language materials at the time, within Arabic geographical traditions. But one of the things that he also recognises as being quite important about these French geography books is the particular kind of order and method that's put into them. I mean, these really are, it's the Nouvelle Géographie Méthodique. So he refers to the detail and organisation of these French books. And so, you know, one of the most obvious places you find that is in tables. So this is the planets of the solar system, because cosmography also forms part of this. So there's physical geography and cosmography, and then also political geography and social geography in these books. And you know, so you can see the kind of legibility that is one of the features of this kind of geographical discourse. It's very different to the sort of the earlier Arabic geographic tradition, some bits of which were certainly known to Tartawi, although exactly which ones is less obvious. It's also interesting that in his introduction to this book, he refers to the first map that's ever made in the world. This is the quotation, which I've translated. The first map in the world, he says, was drawn by King Sesostris, or Sesoc, the first king of Egypt. He conquered the country. He made subjects to himself the rulers of India and of Yemen, and he wanted to make plain to the people of Egypt the greatness of his rule and the extent of his dominion, so he drew for them a picture of what his rule contained, and this was the first map. This is the story he tells in the preface. Now, this idea is not entirely foreign to Tahtawi's project, because Mehmed Ali, who's also succeeded in making himself master of Egypt and of a number of the surrounding countries by this point, the 1830s, this is 1834, this is published. What Tahtawi does is, into this very kind of Eurocentric book of Misas and Michelot, which largely concentrates on, you know, France and around France, Europe, to a much greater extent than it does on the rest of the world, he adds in parts from Malte-Brun's Précis de Géographie Universelle, much more detailed parts about the provinces of the Asian Ottoman Empire, and particularly those that are under the rule of Mehmed Ali at the time. And as he says at one point in the book, maybe I don't have that quotation, but yeah, so you can see basically which part of the world we're talking about. So do I have it? Yeah. He says basically what we should do in this book is to go in more detail into the lands of Egypt, Nubia, the Sudan, the provinces of the Hejaz and Beled al-Sham, so Syria, more extensively than we should look at other countries, because they have been numbered among the Egyptian countries, so that is, they become part of a sort of a greater Egyptian space. How much time do I have now? Am I?
You still have 5 minutes.
Okay, oh, that's fine. Okay, I'm rushing more than I need to.
Oh, let's say 7.
Fine. So these are those countries, you know. So we have from Egypt down into the Hejaz, up into Syria, also into Africa. So Nubia, by Nubia, Nolba, they really refer to the bit between. Between Upper Egypt and Khartoum, I think, at this stage. And then Sudan, Beled al-Sudan, the land of the blacks, literally, is the bits of the south of that, which Mehmed Ali's forces have also, you know, penetrated into at this point. One of the other changes he makes to these geography books is to actually insert these elements of national statistics, which he's taken from a memorandum prepared for him by Jomard. These aren't in the textbook of Misas and Michelot. They aren't in Malte-Brun either. Malte-Brun is a bit out of date. These are relatively up to date, I think, and they're prepared specially by Jomard. So this is Portugal, this example, which we have in Arabic. So we have the figures for its military strength, its annual revenue, and the size of the national debt. So again, this attempt to find a kind of a systematic, comparable way in which different countries can be compared to each other and their relative sort of strength really assessed, which again one doesn't find in earlier sort of Arabic geographical texts in quite that form, and which I think also shows that, you know, he is adding elements of political concern, elements that are really about realpolitik, to something which in its French original, in Misas et Michelot's version, is much more of a school text. This is, after all, a book that's destined for officials of a sort of highly militarized administration that's ruling a number of these countries of the Middle East. Another thing that, so when he's sort of going through the text, particularly of these Egyptian countries, where he's putting in bits from Misas et Michelot, bits from Malbrun, he's changing quite a lot, he's moving things around. And one of the, again, the little passages in detail where he changes things is where a lot of the European travellers in Syria and Egypt, from at least from Volney onwards, basically they're the materials that Malbrun is using. A lot of them had referred to the difference between contemporary Syria as they saw it and Syria in the ancient or the biblical past. So Volney, for instance, uses Josephus, the Jewish historian. He says, Josephus describes Syria as being much more prosperous and populous than it is now. Obviously, this is the effect of the decadence of the Ottoman Empire, of the, you know, the ills of Oriental rule, etc. So Malbrun kind of follows this narrative. Again, I'm not sure if I've... No, we have something else there. He follows Volney in saying essentially the disorder and corruption of the Ottoman regime under the Persians and emirs of the Druze and the Arab tribes has led to this country being in a deplorable condition, and he finishes this reflection, which I think quite clearly derives from Volney, by writing that, I'll quote, "Such is the deplorable condition of a country rich in its soil, important in its local position, and which might, by a new crusade, be easily wrested from the grasp of its barbarous oppressors." So there's this notion, that Syria would do much better under European rule. That this would be evidenced in terms of production, in terms and population. When Tohtawi translates this, unsurprisingly, he changes quite a lot. One of the things, Malbrun is writing before the provinces of Syria became occupied by Egypt. So what Tohtawi does is essentially he says, well, now, obviously, these provinces have become part of the Egyptian ruled area. Before that, they used to be, in this state of confusion and injustice. Now, God willing, inshallah, it will have left behind soon the injustice of these Persians and of the Arabs because of the benign rule of the dispenser of bounties, as he calls him, Mehmed Ali Pasha, the ruler of Egypt. And he then goes on to say, and again I quote, "One of the European authors has said that if this doesn't take place, that is this change under Egyptian rule, it would be easy for it to be conquered by a European invasion and it would fall into European hands. So the only way for it to attain this kind of civilized status without being under European control is under Egyptian control." So I will just go very quickly into this other element, which I think is particularly interesting, where he inserts, he's translating Mises and Michelot, but he's translating them in a particular way. They have this kind of enlightenment hierarchy of levels of civilization. As this quote, which I won't read because you can see it up there, points out, people can be divided according to this enlightenment idea by the way in which they live, There are different grades, nomads, barbaric people, and then civilized people of culture and elegance and so on. He translates this into Arabic using a vocabulary which is, I mean, it makes sense as a translation, but it also very much refers back to earlier Arabic traditions of Khaldunian distinctions between settled and nomad life, and, you know, earlier than that, things which go back to the ancient Greeks, so the Badu and Hadar, and the idea of Itinas and Ta'ayush. Living together in society versus people who don't. So this is one of these instances where you can see a European Enlightenment-derived hierarchy being superimposed on what is actually already a kind of a sort of particularly urban elite ideology of difference that exists in Egypt at this time. Interestingly, I will finish on this point, when he divides the peoples of the world into this hierarchy, he places within the first grade, the most primitive people, the nomads of countries like Sudan, but also America, who are still like roaming beasts, who do not know right from wrong, who are driven by their passions as their desires decree, like beasts, like animals. Into the second grade, he puts Bedouin Arabs of the desert. Into the third grade, he puts people like those of Egypt, of Syria, Turks, Persians, Arabs. He doesn't actually mention the Europeans at all, people of al-Maghrib and of China and America and so on. So, so he's placing within this first category of civilization, as European geographers would not have done at that time, largely, the people of his own societies, whereas he's placing those that they're ruling over, such as nomadic Arabs and people of the Sudan, into these other categories, which can also be compared across the world. I think I've gone over a little bit. I'm very sorry. I will finish on that just by saying that this is also a very, this question of civilizational status is also a very practical thing, because Mehmed Ali's attempt to prove that his rule of Egypt is civilized is one of the justifications in European terms of allowing him to rule Egypt and the countries around it. Lord Palmerston in 1840 engineers a British intervention along the Syrian coast to drive his armies out of Syria. Very early, very shortly before doing this very kind of practical military intervention on the coast, he writes a letter to another British statesman saying that Mehmed Ali's boasted civilization of Egypt is the arrantest humbug he has ever come across. It's complete nonsense and hypocritical. So again, the notion of civilizational status can have a very kind of direct political impact in this context. Thank you very much.